My guest today is Dave Thompson, whose passion, or what he might call his obsession, with Napa Valley wines has led him to create probably the number one website for people interested in Napa Valley wineries, NapaWineProject.com. Just Google most wineries and you'll normally see NapaWineProject.com as one of the top 3 to 5 sites. We so often romanticize about a certain lifestyle without recognizing how much work and devotion the people in it make to their craft. One could say that about wine, and talking with Dave, one can understand how it applies to travel writing as well. In Dave's case, his love for Napa Valley wines and their stories has led him to visit, taste, and review over 1,050 wineries over 15 years, with hundreds of revisits. Even with such extensive Napa Valley coverage, it's only part of his passion for travel as he explores the world writing, taking photographs, and sharing in depth and with great detail about these places on his website, davestravelcorner.com. On top of that, he's built up and shares his explorations with almost 4,000 followers on Twitter. It's a fascinating conversation where we get to see his inspiration and a behind-the-scenes look at the life of a modern-day wine and travel blogger. I hope you enjoy listening and learning as much as I did. Enjoy. Behind every place is a story, and behind every story are the people. Thank you for joining our conversation with the people behind the places, sponsored by Be Local. We'll explore their lives, inspirations, challenges, lessons learned, and anything interesting in between. The Be Local platform is introducing the art of experience curation, where we combine local insight from real people with intuitive tech to curate inspiring travel experiences and itineraries uniquely matched to you. We're excited for you to join us on this journey of exploring the lives of the people behind the places. Okay, so Dave, do people always ask you, like, how did you get such a dream job, or like, how did you get such a dream life? I mean, do people like often talk to you like that, pretty envious?
Yes, if they don't know me personally and they just see the content on the internet, it looks like a dream life. And to some extent, I suppose it is, but there's a lot of work that's gone into this and a lot of effort. And I got in really early on the digital space, as far as it wasn't called blogging back in 1996 when I started my travel website. So there was no like blogging wave to follow, I guess you could say.
Oh, really?
It was just me making my own path. There was very few travel websites in 96. If you look at newspaper sites that were around then, like Los Angeles Times, use like Wayback Machine. It's a website that captures old websites.
Right.
It was very rudimentary. I mean, really, really basic. And the software I was using was extremely basic. There was no WordPress. There was no easy to use
right.
content management systems like there are today. I really started seeing the numbers of travel and wine writers, bloggers increase like around 2008, I would say.
Did that coincide with like some of the software that made it easier, some of the websites?
Yeah, exactly. These content management systems are just plug and play. They're really easy to use, and website or web hosts offering those services, as well as finally internet access before this becoming faster. I mean, when I started, it was 4,800 baud modem and 9,600 baud modem, like really slow.
Wow.
So yeah, we've come a long ways.
Well, some places have come a long ways.
Which has opened up the space to thousands and thousands of
right.
people who want to do this.
Well, how does that affect you now in like, as someone who has such deep roots in the industry, who has kind of paid your dues, and then now people can come in and so easily become an Instagram travel star or influencer. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, mm-hmm. how do you feel about all that? And like, and how do you stay ahead, or how do you stay relevant?
Sure. I don't see any of that as competition. I just see it as more content, which of course can be overwhelming at times. But I got in early enough, and I built the number of contacts and built my network over the years, which has kept me going and keeps me going. So I'm part of a number of writing groups and professional organizations that focus on travel writing, travel journalism, and photography. And then just some networking groups.
Are these professional groups that feed you business, or are they just kind of mutual support groups?
They're both. So I've gotten some really good contracts and contacts from participating in these groups. And they see my history, and they see my consistency, and they see my style of writing, and they see the website and the community that I've built over the years. And so I've used those as platforms to introduce me to PR people, tourism boards, hospitality boards, resorts in certain cases, credit card companies.
Right.
And these companies also find me online, but they do look at, they, we do meet in person normally, normal years. And so just those relationships and getting into this industry so early has given me a step up for sure.
Right.
Versus someone, I would not recommend someone coming in and becoming a travel blogger right now to make money. Do it if you love it, but have a backup plan, or don't have a backup plan, but have something else to fall back on. Start it as a hobby.
For those
who are retired, it's a fun hobby/career.
Right.
So they've made money somewhere else. They want to get into travel writing. And I do get trips. Tours and boards offer me trips because they know me. Some are paid, most are not, and they cover all the cost of the flight and the hotels and the attractions. And so what they want when the writer returns is the content published on my website
and
promoted on my website.
Of course. Well, before I get into kind of some of the nuts and bolts of that, which a lot of people probably are curious about but don't understand, maybe it would be helpful to do a little introduction of kind of your – where people can find your, who you are and what you are, and take a few minutes of that, not too much, because we'll learn a lot about you as we go.
Sure. So I love travel and I love wine and I love meeting people. And I've just had no plans for this lifestyle. I started out working at a friend's internet service provider after I graduated from college. Not even related to my degree, which was from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, a degree in biology with a focus on plants. So I had no plan. I guess this all started back.
And what is this? Because again, people, like, can you explain what this is?
Sure.
What do you do?
Sure. Okay. So I am a travel writer and I'm a travel photographer and I am a wine writer. And I work on the travel side of things. I work with brands and destinations and companies in the travel sphere to promote experiences or places or spaces. They hire me. They'll send me on a trip somewhere. They'll use my social media outlets that I have established to promote either their destination or maybe it's a resort.
And what are your main outlets for travel and wine that people would find?
Two websites that I have published are davestravelcorner.com, started that in 1996. And then the second is more niche focus and region focused, and that's napawineproject.com. And that is focused on wineries in Napa Valley exclusively, and any places or spaces strongly connected to said wineries in the Napa Valley, anywhere on the planet.
Right.
And so that's a completely separate project from my website, travel website. So the wine project, I'm visiting, tasting, and writing about every single winery in Napa Valley and every brand and every tasting room.
Which is crazy because there's over 1,000. And like, I don't know anyone who is anywhere near the scope that you have as far as the sheer percentage that you visited. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I'm at 1,050 right now, just in Napa Valley. And that's 15 years of work, hundreds and hundreds of revisits to keep things current on my reviews.
Right.
So I meet the owners. The criteria is I meet at least someone from the winery or someone from the brand, because often they don't have a physical winery. They rent space at someone else's winery. And I interview them, I talk, or it's not more of a, it's less of an interview, it's more of a chat like we're having.
Right.
And I want stories, and I take my own tasting notes. I always try the wines. I want to see the vineyards, if they own vineyards or if they source from certain vineyards. I want to see those. And just, I get really detailed, and if there's a historical element, I you got to pick your obsessions, but history is one of my obsessions, and so I'll dig really deep.
Yeah, it's super cool.
A friend of mine recently granted me access to her newspapers.com account, and that's been a... just a rabbit hole that just like an hour turns into 10 hours. And all
is it like old microfiche that's been converted to online or something like that?
Yeah. It gives you access back to the, I think the late 1700s, 1790s of newspapers.
Oh, really?
International. Google has none of this. Absolutely none of this. It's incredible. Yeah. It's all the newspapers, and it's a very powerful search engine because you can clip and paste and send PDFs of
so cool.
And it's amazing. It's
okay. So I'm curious. I did a little bit of reading on the history of Napa and Sonoma, like the founding of California and that time. Are you kind of very familiar with that time?
I'm familiar with, as it relates to Napa Valley and the original founders of the wine scene in Napa Valley.
Okay.
And to some extent it ties into the, I mean, even earlier back to the missions, the first grapes commercially planted in, well, Sonoma County has grapes at Fort Ross that were planted like around 1810, 12, 15. Those are some of the earliest grapes that were actually cultivated here.
Now, earliest grapevines. So they've got 200-year-old grapevines.
Yeah, they're no longer around. The oldest vine I know of in the state of California is the Ramona vine down in Los Angeles at Mission. I'm blanking on the mission name.
Yep.
But that dates from 17...
San Antonio? Was it Mission San Antonio or
something? No. That San Antonio is the winery.
The winery.
Still there, and they actually have a vineyard in Rutherford that they produce fruit from.
Okay.
But no, this is at the Mission.
One of the actual missions.
Mission San Gabriel, I think it is.
Okay.
They just had a big fire a couple months ago. But that's the Ramona vine. It dates from 1776. And I've been to that vine, and it's amazing how the canopy and the trellis system.
250 years.
Size of the trunk. Yeah.
Oh, my
goodness.
That's
the oldest one in the state that I know of. So the winemaking dates back to the missions. And Los Angeles in particular is where the early history of winemaking in California started. Like right where ABC Studios is in Burbank, that was vineyards and the Arts District, that used to be all vineyards.
Oh, really?
Downtown, south of downtown. So,
yeah, I actually grew up in Pasadena, further east in San Gabriel Valley. And you look at some of the old photos and, you know, it was just tons of agriculture. I mean, that's why the town, one of the main streets was called Orange Grove, you know, because there were orange groves everywhere.
Yes, and there's you go a little further east, Ontario, down by the airport there. There's still some old head prune vineyards out there.
Really?
But that was a lot of vineyards were down there.
Really? Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and was it the missions or was it just the settlers who just loved their wine?
It was for actual vineyards, multiple vines. It was the missions.
Okay.
Mission San Juan Capistrano was one of the earliest, and Mission San Diego had early vines.
Okay.
I mean, those dated back to the 1770s, 80s, 90s. So those were the earliest vines planted in the state of California.
And what I was reading is that the Sonoma Mission was quite a central hub of the civilization. I don't know the dates, but in the general kind of Napa-Sonoma area, I mean, back then, Sonoma was the hub, not Napa. Napa was kind of the boondocks a little bit.
Yes, you're right. The earlier grapes were planted in Sonoma. And just from Charles Sullivan, is one of the preeminent historians on wine history in Napa-Sonoma, and he talks about cuttings coming from Sonoma and being brought over by George Yount. So the first grapes... all the extensive research I've done that were actually planted in Napa Valley were sometime in the winter, the fall winter of 1838, 1839.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah.
1839, and Lewis and Clark came over in, was it 1805 or 6 to the Northwest?
The river,
So that's pretty, pretty quick. 30 years from the kind of first European explorers to some significant settlements.
Correct. And you look at the wagon trains that came over in the like 1846 and then the Donner Party around that time. That's when some of the earliest, besides Yount, some of the first settlers came to Napa Valley around that time. Like John Kongsgaard's family dates back to the late 1840s.
Really?
The Tench family along the trail in Oakville, Margaret Tench, her family goes back to that same wagon trail. They met up at the Donner Party, but then they split. And so they were not, side of the family was not actually caught up in the actual Donner tragedy in the Sierra Nevada. And then, of course, you got the Pinas came a little bit later. And there's some.
Is Pina? I didn't know Pina was that old.
Yeah, I don't think they were here. I think they were like mid-1850s.
Oh, I had no idea.
When their family came in, like 1856, I think, something like that. And
yeah, so for people listening, when he says Pina, I'm assuming you're talking about Davy Pina?
Yeah, correct. Davy, the four brothers, one has died. But yes, the longtime vineyard management company, and they have the winery as well.
Right. So for people listening, they are a vineyard management company, as Dave mentioned, which is... A lot of people hire people who have that expertise, the manpower and the physical resources, the tractors, et cetera, to manage the vineyards for them. So they're kind of a farm labor contractor, they say. And Pina is one of the preeminent ones. And I had no idea his roots went that deep. That's super cool. He was also very active, as you know, in the fires.
He's a volunteer.
Yeah, isn't he like a volunteer chief or something in the Santa Elena Fire Department?
Yeah, the one right next to, really close to their winery in Rutherford.
Okay. And I would always hear about...
If you want...
Go ahead.
Oh, we're on from sort of history now, but I just wanted to mention that even though Charles Krug gets credited as being the first commercial winery in the valley, Patchett's Grove Winery was the first commercial winery in Napa, 1857.
Where is that one?
Charles. There's a Patchett Street in the city of Napa. It's on the Napa Creek side. It's not far from Highway 29. It's all subdivision. It's all homes now. Looking at the historical records, it's hard to come up with it. I think it's been lost. I can't find anything exact location, but it's somewhere in that Patchett Street, somewhere in that area.
Okay.
Where the new, I mean, not everyone knows the city of Napa, but where they built the two new roundabouts.
Okay. A little bit towards the west side of Napa, which is tends to be a little more residential and a couple commercial streets.
Correct. And actually, Charles Krug was his hired winemaker.
Oh, that's cool.
At that time. And John Patchett's buried in the Tulake Cemetery. He has a prominent gravesite there.
So for people listening also, I mean, you, in addition to doing these reviews and going to Napa and visiting all these wineries, I mean, you also hold private tours and tastings. And I mean, that's kind of got to be a treat for people who go, especially if they're wine geeks or love a deeper story about the area and the wineries. I mean, do you have like repeat people coming back over and over because of that?
Yeah. And I've gotten to know some of these people and gotten to really know them. And it's cool when they come back. And when they first came out, they gave me a number of wineries they wanted to see, and then I put together itinerary, and then they got to know me and my level of experience and knowledge of the valley, and now I basically plan the whole trip and they just leave it to me.
Well, and they know that every
focusing. Yeah.
Yeah, every time they come back, I mean, because you're always revisiting wineries and there's always new wineries, I mean, they know you're gonna have local insight that very few people have as far as where to go. So they can just kind of leave it in your hands and say, hey, let's try something new.
That's right. And when I revisit a winery, I'm constantly collecting data, whether it's my own reviewing new vintages, tasting notes. And if I hear something that I don't know that's not in my review, I'll make a note and I will add it later. And I should say as well that I'm visiting any place or space within reason around the state, the country, and the planet that is strongly connected to any winery in Napa Valley.
Now, is that... I mean, that's super cool. And that's brought you to some amazing places because people in Napa come from all over the world and a lot of them have many projects all over the world. So is that just following your own passion? I mean, are is there any like kind of business reason for that, or is it just developing content, or what inspired
developing
that part
content,
of it?
It's obsession.
Okay.
So this whole project.
I appreciate that. That sounds pretty honest.
This whole project started out as curiosity 15 years ago. I made my first wine in high school. That was my first introduction to wine. I knew nothing about wine at that time, and so just started visiting larger wineries, and just it became educational over time. So it started out as curiosity, then passion, and now it's absolute obsession, but still curiosity and passion.
Well, what's so cool is like that passion and obsession has evolved into like what kind of site visitors are you getting to each of your sites? Because it's pretty darn significant.
Yeah, so the wine project gets about 40,000 visitors a month, which is pretty good.
That's massive.
A lot of that traffic is from people just they're searching for a specific winery, so they come across a specific review on my site, whether it's
right.
Charles Kruger, whatever winery out there. So that's where a lot of that traffic comes from. And then I like this when wineries link back to me and promote it on their end, so that brings a little bit more traffic. And it's all organic. I don't do any Google ads.
That blows me away. And I know I asked you about that on the side sometime, and it was so cool to hear your answer. I said, Dave, like, if anybody goes to look at wineries, the vast majority of the wineries, when you type in their name, Napa Wine Project will come up as the top 2 to 5 responses on Google's first page.
Typically.
So I'm like, okay, Dave, so how did you do that? What's your SEO secret? And you're like, they're like, there's no secret. And I talked to my business partner, Derek, about this, and I didn't tell you afterwards. Uh-huh. And it was so cool because I said, explained it. And he said, well, that's actually how it's supposed to work. You know, you develop genuine content, and it's supposed to pull up the genuine content that is to help your search rather than gaming the system to pretend that it's fitting for you, but it's really just steering people towards something they're selling or whatever. So it was such a cool, authentic example of you're just following your passion, you're doing the work, and in turn, like, people may not know you, like, by name. But then as soon as I, you know, and then they're like, oh, yeah, no, of course I know Dave, after they later look up and, you know, you've reviewed everyone. Right. And it's just so impressive.
It's been a labor of love, and it remains that. I do take usually 2 to 2.5 months off every winter and just don't write about wine and don't try not to think about it, even though it's difficult, and stay off social media when it comes to wine. So it's just a refresher because this project is so intense and so much time and just all encompassing day and night. All I do is think about Napa, dream about Napa, write about Napa, taste Napa. It's a full-time, more than full-time. So I need that refresher. And if I didn't have that each year, I would probably burn out, I think, but I don't want to take that risk. So I force myself just to take the time off.
And coming back to the kind of the business side of things, I think you touched on something I'd like to ask a little more about is how you work hard. So it is a passion, but you do a lot of work for it. And it's not all, I shouldn't say not necessarily strategic, because like we were saying, I mean, your passion guides the content and the content naturally brings you up in the search engines and how often you refresh and stuff. But like, can you talk a little bit about that combination of passion and work ethic? Because a lot of people idealize, like you kind of alluded to, the lifestyle, et cetera, without realizing how much work it can be to succeed.
Sure. And because this is my passion and it is costly, I'm covering the cost of the travel expenses and all of that. Not many people would be crazy enough to devote their life to something like that. So the wine site itself is passion and obsession, and that itself is not focused. It's not where I make my money.
Okay.
I don't know if I mentioned how all this started, like way back.
Not yet.
Okay. So I took a college trip to Nepal in 1996 and became deathly ill climbing up, trekking up to Everest Base Camp in Calipatar.
Oh my goodness. And were you going to climb Everest?
No, we were not at that point. Never. And I became really, really sick, and my guide started recognizing signs of edema and going downhill really fast if I didn't get down the mountain. And this was
so it's altitude sickness?
Plus food poisoning.
Oh, yeah.
Great combo.
Yeah.
So we left it. Yeah, we left at midnight, and he carried me on his shoulders because I wasn't really able to walk very much at that point. And a lady went with us, stout, a little bit shorter than myself, and dropped us off at a stone hut about after hiking 3 hours, and stayed with me with us for like an hour and said, "You're looking a little better, get some sleep." And then he went back up the mountain to the rest of the group, which got back like at 7 a.m. So it was an all-nighter for him. And then, so I threw up all night, filled up a big bowl, completely frozen solid by morning. So that shows you how cold it was inside this stone hut. And then in the morning, I physically could not stand at all. And I kept throwing up again. We had both our backpacks, sleeping bags with us. And so we decided she was going to carry me down the mountain. And she did so, bringing both our backpacks far down the trail, dropping them off, and then coming back for me, putting me on her shoulders. We had a sleeping bag that we sort of fashioned out of sling as a sling at times, but it wasn't easy. And so dropping me off, and she, we just did this whole thing all day, all day, all day. And she left a note taped to one of the stone huts, written note just asking, pleading for help. We're still going down the mountain. And finally, one of the porters came, really thin guy, much smaller than myself, and he helped carry me. And by the end of the day, we had, she and I had collapsed on the ground. We were both crying.
Oh, my goodness.
And we had finally gotten low enough that the energy came back and I was able to stand and actually walk and felt so much better. And so that was a trip that is like, it wasn't great at the time, but it was a trip that's so powerful that stuck with me for
so
at least
you're like,
a year.
I got to do more of this. Like,
yeah. I mean, ultimately it didn't sound like that would be the case, but yeah, I just hooked on international travel
really?
At that point. And it was through the travel that I discovered Napa Valley, even though I grew up in Sonoma.
Okay.
And I created the wine project started as just a travel focused wine related article
right.
on my travels.
Wait a second. You grew up in Sonoma and you focus on Napa. Do your friends there just give you such a hard time about that? Because their favorite joke whenever I go over
Sonoma
makes wine, Napa makes auto parts. That's their line.
No, there's none of that. And there's so many connections to wine in Napa.
Of course,
in
of
Sonoma
course.
And vice versa. I chose Napa because even though it's so close, I find a lot of people do not. I mean, they've never been to the city of Napa. I mean, it's an hour away from Santa Rosa.
Really?
And I chose Napa because I wasn't as familiar with that region as I was with Sonoma County. And it's easier to understand from a geographical perspective.
Right.
Because it is a valley and there's two mountain ranges and it's not as spread out as Sonoma.
And it's all wine. I mean, mostly.
Yeah, exactly. Sonoma's more diverse. And arguably, Napa has a little bit better international reputation. And I've been very international focused in my travels over the years. So there's a lot of reasons.
Right.
I forgot what your original question was.
Well, no, it was great hearing how you got inspired about travel in general.
Yes.
That was just super interesting.
And that was in Nepal, and we spent time doing safari and spending time in Kathmandu, where I saw burning bodies and the ashes floating in the river, which is part of their custom, and just monkeys everywhere. It's just, and the food was so different. I'd never been exposed to anything like that before in my life. And so it was just a sensory overload, and just, it really stuck with me.
So did you immediately, and how old were you at the time?
I was, like 19. Or 20, I guess I would have been like right.
And did you immediately like look at doing it for work?
No, not at all. I couldn't afford it.
Okay.
I didn't even. It was just a hobby at that point.
Right.
And when I started, it was a subdomain, so it was not even its WWO and website.
Okay.
Many commercial websites and hobby websites back then were like part of established websites. So it's like earthlink.com/whatever
your business
was.
I forgot about that.
Was
like
very,
AOL
very,
had
very
their whole
common.
Kind of environment.
Yeah, and GeoCities, whatever. How you
right.
say. And yeah, all these sites that you would do, they call them subdomains. They're just like the main website plus whatever your business was or
right.
your website was.
Well, I was asking before about that, if you could kind of elaborate on that balance or combination of passion and work ethic.
Yes.
Because yes, it was, you didn't have a clear path. There wasn't a path that said, especially back then, that said, you know, oh, go this way and you can make a living as a travel writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so how did you even find that path? It was just, you know, you just kind of was forging ahead yourself or.
Yeah, it was just, it started out as a hobby. I had a job at least.
Okay.
I was working for the internet service provider back then.
Okay.
It was a time when everything was dial-up.
Right.
DSL hadn't come on, cable and all this other stuff.
So kind of like some of Napa Valley's internet speeds now.
Yeah.
At least at my home office it is. I'm on DSL.
Yeah. It's just the cell service in the valley is so bad.
Yeah. It's an interesting dynamic, but I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
My own.
No, that's fine. So I had a full-time, like way more than full-time job building this internet provider back in the day with friends. So my travels were very limited. They were vacation, a couple weeks, week here, a couple days here. And because of budget, they were tended to be more statewide and domestic rather than long, far-flung international trips.
Right.
But I just kept at it as a hobby and just trusted my gut, whatever felt right, following what my lifestyle and what I like to do, which was be outdoors, travel, food.
Right.
At that point.
And looking at your website, you're pretty consistent in generating content, correct? Is that pretty important?
Yes.
My guess it is.
Yes. Yes. And it has slowed down this year, for obvious reasons. But I have a lot of travelers that use my site as a platform to promote their own trips and their own journals and
that's awesome.
Their own content. And so I have, I don't know, 700, 600, and I have like 40, 50 that I really trust who I will actually send on press trips, fan trips, they call them.
Okay.
So I get the content, because I can't. I've been to a lot of these places or I just have no desire to go. And
right.
These are often very structured, regimented trips with a tight schedule
right.
on what the destination wants the writers to see and experience.
Right. And you're a little more go with the flow kind of guy.
Yeah, actually.
Follow
I've been
the
on
inspiration.
A number of these trips and I like them as well, but I do like the flexibility of traveling by myself or just being a little.
And you've done a bit of traveling this year. I mean, how have you been able to do it to kind of stay safe or do you just kind of trust in the universe and like don't really worry about it?
Yeah, I have zero fear. I have zero fear over the current situation. And I say that with absolute, complete honesty.
Okay.
I was in Australia, Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, Thailand, Singapore, and Vietnam.
This year?
Until the end of, this year. But that was until end of February. And so then I came back to the U.S. Lockdown hit in mid-March.
Right.
I immediately took off and did three pretty extended road trips across the United States from mid-March through June. Made it as far. And then to some extent, these were Napa-focused trips. So I stayed at resorts. I was one of like less than five people at several resorts that are owned by winery owners in Napa Valley. So
okay.
I was in Dallas at the Hall Arts. I was Trinitas Cellars has a couple of resorts in Laguna and Huntington Beach or La Jolla. I mean, and then I made as far as Detroit one trip. There's a lot of winery connections there with Tom Chelani. He's got a winery just north of the city of Napa, Oaknall area. Trinitas again, the Bush family, they own markets. Craig Hall, Catherine Hall, their first house they ever bought, started his real estate empires in Ann Arbor, a rooming house. It's still a rooming house. So just stuff like that I would visit. Another trip, I was up in Wyoming and Colorado visiting more winery connections to Napa Valley. One was a farm out there. One was a big ranch.
That's pretty amazing.
I tried... It was weird because some places were closed, some places were open, but people were very friendly and people welcomed me. I had no problem traveling doing that. And then internationally, last month, I flew to French Polynesia, the Tuamotos, and visited probably one of the most unique wineries on the planet. They have 15 acres of vines growing on coral in the Tuamotos, which is far, far east French Polynesia.
Growing on coral?
Growing in coral, yes. They started this project in the late 90s. It's incredible. They have a boat. They pick the grapes. Grenache is one of the varieties. An Italian Moscato is another variety, and I'm blanking on the third one. They pick the grapes. They load them into the boat, and they ferry them about 15 minutes across this incredible aquamarine water to another island where the actual winery is located.
Oh, my goodness.
They make the wine. They make the wine there.
Wow, that sounds unbelievable.
It is, and there was no tourists out there. It was all locals, and so a friend and I went, and it was just, oh, God, it was so nice. It was so nice to get away.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
And then just I did domestic stuff. I did D.C. last week in Virginia and Maryland, visiting some wineries connected to Napa, Ehlers Estate, and Bouchain Connection, and a bunch of other things, restaurants, right. Eritas.
It must have been really kind of strange to come back to Napa to such kind of chaos. And I mean, doesn't it feel weird sometimes when you're away and there's serious fires going back, and then you went back and then there were new fires?
Yeah, I got back that Monday and I immediately went to Calistoga and spent almost all week staying at my friends, the Tedeschi's, and they had two flatbeds and totes and a hook up to the fire hydrant. And so it was really awesome. It really, really felt good to be on the front lines and actually be helping out during that time.
Because people were literally fighting fires on their own properties, right?
Yeah, they were too. Oh, yeah, yeah. People stayed. Calistoga was evacuated, but there was certainly some people that stayed. It helped when we got our ag permit after, because we kept getting pulled over by the local police and not local police, wondering what we were doing there.
Right.
But we were helping out. I mean, we were bringing, and the Tedeschi's are an amazing family. They brought water to the firefighters as it was coming in through the transformer there on the northeast part of town. And we brought water to AXR and a bunch of properties up on Spring Mountain. And
right.
It was just it felt very rewarding to have a doing something directly to help the valley.
Right. I mean, in the valley's gone through. Not long after I got there, in about 2010, you know, we had the earthquake and then we had multiple fires and floods and the strength of community there has always been so impressive.
Yeah. The resilience and the persistence and the strength that you nailed it exactly. And it's a small valley and it's a small community and people help each other out during these times. And I've really embraced that. I want to promote that as much as possible.
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of mentioned before how Davey Pena, I mean, you heard it this every fire, you hear about him using his own tractors that they use to plow and plant new vineyards to clear fire breaks. Because, you know, the firemen they're stretched so thin, and Andy's a fireman. So it's like, he's got the expertise and he's got the equipment and the goodwill to try and help. It's pretty impressive.
And you find out the old timers do that in the valley. And during the fires, water was basically gold. And just there's firefighters there from all over the state and out of the state and in the past out of the country. And they don't know their way around. And so just being there among them, being able to help them with directions. Oh, there's a house up here. And I know this person is down here and there's a winery over here. And here's a fire hydrant, which I got to know about a little bit on the fire hydrant perspective. Last month, but just stuff like that can be helpful. And they take notes. The firefighters we were talking to were taking meticulous notes with phone numbers so they could call you if they needed extra water. And
because it was devastating. I mean, that was probably the most devastating natural disaster we've had as far as the commercial winery side of things.
Agreed. 100%. 100%. It's grim.
Yeah. I mean, I drove through there a week and a half ago, St. Helena, Calistoga, and just seeing wineries in places that, you know, just were totally devastated. And then others like the 17 fires that driving up Soda Canyon Road, it's like 7 or 8 out of 10 houses are gone, but one in the middle, for some reason, it's there. And it's just, you're like, how did that happen?
and for your Yeah. For your listeners outside of Napa, we're talking about 30 wineries from this fire, but a lot of landscape in certain parts of the valley. So we're not talking about the entire valley burned, and that's there's a lot of the valley that did not burn.
At all. This is really in the kind of between St. Helena and Calistoga, so the northern part of the valley.
Correct. Yeah, and so, Spring Mountain above St. Helena, and then Deer Park above St. Helena on the other side of the valley. Yes. Yeah. Right. So it's not. It was very expensive, but it's not the entire valley.
Yeah. Well, that's. I mean, that's always true. It's like, you know, it's such a diverse valley, and there's so many wineries. I mean, as far as visitors go, we went basically as soon as people started going back and it got cleared up and you had blue skies. I mean, the skies have been gorgeous there.
Oh, gosh. The last few weeks.
Yeah. So, and it's in the 70s, early 80s, you know, and when I was in Montana, it was, like I said, like 20 or 15 was a high and the low was like negative 12. So coming back to like 80 degree weather felt really weird.
Yeah. That's a shock.
So where do you like to, like, you're like, got to be like the master, the guru of like the hidden gems in Napa. What are a couple of your places you like to take people? And maybe we'll say a kind of a lower price point and a higher price point, because there is a difference.
Yeah. Okay. I'll start with if money is no object. Price
okay.
Point.
Perfect.
And some of these you cannot get into unless.
Well, can you get into?
I hate
them?
To say it, but I have, but as trade.
Okay.
And some I can get into because I know the GM or something like that.
Talk about places you can take. People can actually go.
Okay.
Like if they know you or if they know someone who's got an insider.
Sure. Okay. Well, I'm going to start even higher than that. I'm going to start at places that are just the cream of the crop that you can't get into.
Okay.
And then I'll start with the next list.
Okay. Sure.
So places that like the top cream would be like Dalaval,
okay,
Kongsgaard, Colgan, Tusk, Bryant family.
Okay.
Places I've been that are just very elevated. Some of my favorite places in the valley are on the hillsides.
Right.
I gravitate towards owner's personality, views, the pedigree of the property, the history of the property, if there's any special architecture, and just the overall feel of the property. That's my formula. That's what I'm looking for, special places.
Right.
Okay. So as far as other higher end special places that are very unique, one of the most unique places in the valley that absolutely no one has heard of is called M.S. Toran. He does 45 cases of wine. He's from Turkey. He spent 7 years living in a 10-by-10 shack, building fences, building roads, all by hand, by pickaxe, with a horse, donkey. His wife would bring food up from the San Jose Bay Area where she lived a couple times a week for him because she was not living there with him. He has like 11,000 olive oil trees. He built a winery. It's all very steep hillside. He has a cave museum that he built out of mud combined with sheep manure. He's got animals. I mean, it's just like,
where is
so
it?
Old world.
I've never
so
heard of
old
it.
World in Napa.
Right.
And his wines are fabulous. 45 cases. That's it. They're very food friendly. Great acid, great balance, great depth.
Oh, that's so cool. And where are they in Napa?
He's above Lake Berryessa in Napa Valley. He's still in the Appalachian.
Oh, how cool.
Because there is part of Napa County that's not in, there's a part of Napa. Yeah. What is that? Napa County is not in Napa Valley. Like the northeast corner of the county is not actually Napa Valley. So if you grow grapes there, you can't call them Napa Valley. You got to call them California Appalachian, Napa County.
Right.
Obscure fact, but not really relevant because there's not many grapes out there. But that's where this gentleman is located, he and his wife. And he makes an amazing lunch. Everything's hand prepared, very Turkish cheeses from his animals. I mean, it's just like, they're so hospitable. It's like going to Turkey.
I love those. I mean, and nowadays there's such refined high-end experiences in Napa, which are wonderful. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of mom and pop places. There's a lot of sweat and blood that people put into it that is so genuine, and it's so directly connected to the owners who are working it.
Sure.
And it's great for people to find those places and hear about them.
Yeah, especially those who have been in the family for generations. Because by numbers, there's not as many of those.
Because
sure. In the last 20 years, we've seen so many family-owned wineries come to the Valley. They've made money somewhere else.
Right.
Or winemakers who have their own brands. Just the numbers have exploded in the last 20 years.
Right.
Like, big, big.
Yeah, the winemakers still, they've got, the cool thing about the winemakers, a lot of them is, if they worked their way up, they still got that passion. I mean, they're really...
Yes.
Hustling. They're not bringing in $1 billion and it's a hobby. I mean, it's like the starving artist to some degree. I mean,
and the only way they can do this is the winery they're working at often will let them use their production facility, or they've got friends who are giving them deals on grapes, or they're helping manage the vineyard in exchange for grapes, stuff like there's ways you can cut costs if you're embedded in Napa Valley.
And it's so important that we have that young blood and that passion in
it. Yes, yes. That creativity that just comes with youth and energy in many cases is important.
So what are some others like
that in the Valley?
What are some others like that that you really love, that owners are so active?
Yeah. I mean, Robinson family in Stag's Leap is one, the Isleys, the Taylors, the Tenches, just getting going with their own brand. The Tedeschi's, absolutely. They've been in the Valley since 1919. The Mondavis, the Charles Krug side, incredible family. The Llewellyns, their heritage goes back to the 1860s. More recent brand to me, but started 4 years ago, is Migliavacca. Her great-great-grandfather, Giacomo, started Migliavacca Wine Co. in 1866, and it was one of the wineries in the city, in what they called Napa City at that time, through Prohibition.
Oh, cool.
With extensive distribution, and Katie has started this brand again, and she loves history, focusing on heritage and some of the wines that he made. The Wagners, if you want a little bit bigger, the Honigs, there's so many still, which is cool, of the old guard, I should say.
Wow. I mean,
McDonald's, the Dieterts. I mean, you can go on and on. There's so many still in this valley.
Right. Like I've been discovering more as I talk to more wineries for Be Local, and you know, we've already got 85 wineries on board, I've reached out to a few hundred. And I find new people, but like you're saying, a lot of these names I still never heard of, and it's just, I love that. I totally love that. So someone, if they do a tour with you, man, they're going to be kind of talk about the inside scoop. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah. And if they want to spend, we can spend. If they're on a budget, we can do that too. Back to your list, the higher end places, like Alejandro Buglaroni or Futo Estate, or Promontory or Checkerboard, Continuum, Constant, top of Diamond Mountain, fantastic property along with Continuum. Those are Seven Stones. Those are just a couple of elevated experiences with higher price points and just often in the hillsides. And but some back to the MS Torin, like that, like Blueford Cellars, Jeff Parody. It's very sad because in the LNU fire, he lost what is probably the greatest private collection in Napa County of mining heritage artifacts tied into wine too, completely burned down. And he had he lives on what was Napa's largest cinnabar mine, which is the ore for mercury, which was used during the wars.
Oh my goodness.
And other things. And there was like 3,000 people. There's Etna Springs, above Etna Springs.
Okay.
And he had a mine shaft, and he had old timbers, and
really?
Yeah. It's just completely burned, everything gone. Oh. The whole private been to the property. It's just so sad. But he makes a wine called Blueford Cellars. And it's just stuff like that. It's just terrible. As far as other wineries, good price points, I mean, Tedeschi's always great if you want a really down-home family experience, long-time family, reasonably priced, diversity of wines. And there's wineries that are easy accessible, like Judd's Hill's got a nice diversity of wines that are at a good price point. And,
right. Yeah, so, I mean, there still are a lot that are accessible if you know where to look.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's just for people, it's so overwhelming because there's over 1,100. There's around 550 physical wineries in the valley, including garage wineries, which cities will allow you to bond commercially in residential neighborhoods.
Right.
And then there's a bunch of industrial park wineries and business park wineries that have no vineyards at that site, but they're surrounded by urban location. So there's around 550 if you tally all of the commercially bonded wineries. And then all the others are brands or they're custom crush.
Right.
They may own the vineyard, they may not. They don't own the winery and they're renting space. So there's over 1,100, at least that I know of, and there's probably a few more. It changes so much. So in the 15 years of 1,050, I've archived 240, I think, right now, because they're no longer making wine commercially in Napa Valley. So
right.
The turnover is remarkable.
Right.
And a lot of those are brands. They don't have the physical investment in the valley.
Right.
But there are also physical wineries that have gone away or changed hands, too.
Wow. That's awesome. So, for people listening, Napa is definitely open and,
yes.
You know, they have yes. outdoor tastings. Currently, they're allowed to do 25% yeah. indoor capacity.
Correct.
We don't
Correct.
Know where it's going to be when this podcast airs. So double check, but they'll most likely be able to at least do the outside tastings, and it's just gorgeous and people are happy to welcome you and, you know, it'd be great.
And then people, I'm finding that people are spending more time with clients.
Right
now, and they're spending more time with me.
Right
when I interview them, and so it's a really nice time to be in the valley. Actually,
it really is. I mean, it's a great opportunity to take advantage of it if you can get up there. Restaurants. I mean, everyone's really happy to welcome people. You know, as much as ever. So, well, thanks, Dave. I mean, it was actually really cool to learn more, and I've got a ton of other questions. So maybe sometime in the future, we'll do a part two.
Yeah, we can go for another hour easily.
Easily. And we're not even drinking.
No, I have not had a drop today.
No, I haven't either. So, because I mean, with your travels, I mean, I would love to hear more stories. And so, we'll do a follow-up at some point.
Yeah, that's good. That's great. Okay. Leave it at that.
But thanks so much. And, if people want to get a hold of you again, go to davestravelcorner.com or Napa Wine Project. And then is there a specific site or do they go to Napa's Wine Project if they want to get an actual tour with you, have you be the host during their whole tour in Napa?
Oh, sure. Yeah, they can go to napawineproject.com. One of the top titles, pull-down titles, is called Tours Concierge. Just click on that.
Okay, perfect.
Right at the top of the page.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Dave. I really appreciate it, and good luck with everything.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
Thank you so much for joining us today. As you can tell, Dave and I had a great time talking, and we actually did end up talking another half hour and could have gone longer. So I look forward to bringing him on again and sharing some more experiences. I did want to confirm that as of January 5th, Napa Valley wineries are not open for tastings. So please check when you are coming. Hopefully later this month they will be open. And I'm sure they will find ways to keep you warm and happy and safe while tasting outside and share their amazing experiences and amazing wines. Also this year, we plan on coming out with a consumer version of our Be Local trip planning platform. So I hope you are able to experience that and look forward to sharing more awesome podcasts with you with these great guests. Thanks so much. Bye.